crazy idea, and he eventually relented and said, hey, I'll give you 50-50. 80-year-old inventor guy. 50-50 if you want to go run with it. What happens is managers today don't do the why and the what very well. Literally, focus on the right things, and the other part gets pretty easy.
Welcome to the Productize Podcast, where we dive deep into the minds of the most innovative and entrepreneurs, spirits, and leaders in product management and design. My name is André Marquet, and for our listeners, this is a quick message to remind you that you have the chance to dive deeper into product topics with over 25 speakers and trainers at the Productize Conference. It's coming to Lisbon, October 3rd and 4th, and Super Hurly Birds. Tickets are still available at www.productize.co until the end of the month. See you there. And today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Jack Skills, the CEO and founder of Agency Agile, former RAND think tank researcher and remarkable figure who has improved agency productivity and culture. Jack, thank you for joining us today.
André, thank you for having me. Very excited about this. So.
All right, Jack. So let's dive into your journey, because you've had a fascinating career from your early days at RAND Corporation to leading now Agency Agile. Can you share with our listeners what drove you to start Agency Agile and its mission, really?
Yeah, it's it was sort of an interesting. My whole career had this sort of strange arc to it around being bounced from one thing to another. I loved doing a lot of things. And after leaving RAND, the think tank, I ended up running or being part of a leadership team in an agency that was a video gaming agency. We did video game launches for big titles and stuff like that. And I realized it's such a crazy organization. And then I was running Sapient's Los Angeles office. Mm-hmm. The global economic downturn hit. And one of the things that happened is, of course, I got laid off during that. And in that exit interview, I tell the story in the book just very quickly, but basically someone said, well, I'm not sure you really managed all that well. And I thought, how could I not have managed well? And this set me on a journey of thinking about how should we really manage? Mm-hmm. And especially how should we manage agencies? And within a few years, after doing some research and some writing and thinking, we were out fixing agencies. And it's interesting. You can take a bad moment like that. And I didn't think of it that way at the time. I was upset, you know, but I took this bad moment and echoed into something that's been amazing to, you know, over 220 agencies now that we've helped improve productivity and happiness and better work, faster work, all that kind of thing. So,
yeah, because your approach combines traditional agile methods with a unique culture-based team empowerment model, I guess. How did you develop these methods and what makes them particularly effective for agencies?
I'll say they're effective also for any multi-manager or project-driven environment. Okay, the thing is that agencies have both of those going on. High-intensity project. If you own or work in an agency, you know the pressure, the constant deadline pressure, right? And that's part of it. It's a project-driven problem, which is your project-oriented organization. The other part is that you've got a multi-manager configuration. You've got a client services managers or account managers, project managers, department managers, you know, on and on and on, right? Mm-hmm. And that creates this unique sort of cauldron, if you will, this sort of bubbling, boiling chaos inside the organization. And it turns out to manage that is a different thing than managing, say, a factory. Okay? Managing chaos requires a different posture as a manager. And in fact, like you said, Agile taught us a few things about that. But largely, the biggest thing we need to do as managers to make these organizations run better is do less managing. Hmm. And that's really the sort of the genesis of the book, Unmanaged, that we just published. The idea is, let's manage less, and will organizations run better? Yes, they do. we could use. We have an epidemic of overmanaging in our workplaces these days.
That's an interesting perspective, which I guess it's also reflected in your recent book, which is called, by the way, Unmanaged. So you synthesize over 50 years of research with practical experience. So what are some of the key insights from the book that our listeners can apply to their organizations to enhance productivity and happiness and, I guess, culture?
Well, I think the first place and probably the only place you can start as an individual manager is with yourself. Hmm. And one of the key things I go into in section one of the book is this idea of what I call the manager tax. And the reality in the research, like you said, the 50 years of research rolling up to this is that essentially the more you manage, the less productive the organization is. And I'll give a really simple example of this. I'm just going to go back to a factory model. I'm a manager in part of a factory. I've got 8 people and they're assembling something, right? Widgets, right? Everyone uses widgets. They're assembling widgets. And I'm sitting in my office and they're assembling widgets. And I decide I want to be managerial. So I'm going to hold a meeting with my team, right? So I'm going to take them off the assembly line and we're going to have a meeting. Now, my act of doing managerial activity just reduced their productivity because when they're in the meeting, they're not producing things.
Yeah.
Okay. So if I, in fact, had been sick that day, they would produce more that day than if I was in there trying to be a manager and doing managerial things, interrupting them, calling them into meetings, all that kind of thing. And that's the fundamental idea, is that the greater the intensity of managing, the more of these interruptions and distractions happen to the sort of core production people in your organization. And with a multi-manager environment, and you talk to people, and many of your listeners live in this world, the day is filled with meetings and you don't get work done during meetings largely. And the meetings are called by whom? It's called by managers. And so just one simple example of how managers can chew up so much productive time in the name of managing. Okay. Managing does not equal productivity. That's the big insight from the research. Managing is the opposite of productivity. The harder I manage, the less productive my organization is.
Okay, so there's for sure an equilibrium towards what is the managerial layer and the amount of meetings and management overhead that goes into that to productivity. Otherwise, you know, management would just be obsolete and there will be no management at all. And I guess that's not what you're defending on the book. I guess the hard thing for most managers is to decide what is too much management and when is management actually getting ahead of productivity and the general interest of the company. So how can managers effectively apply this framework to their daily operations without succumbing to this idea that maybe they are just, you know, unnecessary?
Yeah, that's always that's the challenge with a provocative title, right? I mean, it sounds like my team is unmanaged. Oh my gosh, why don't you go manage it? Like I said, the lower the involvement of managers, this doesn't mean to zero, but there are some interesting things and in the research that actually play out in reality. And Software Agile, which you mentioned, some of the ideas we've used came from Software Agile, but I'm sure many of your listeners know that. You know, the idea behind Software Agile is, for example, maybe a 2-week sprint. And during that time, in general, managers are not interacting with the team.
Right.
I mean, that's sort of the rule, is stay the frick away from the team, right?
Right.
So don't manage the team.
Right. Okay?
So it's been shown to be actually a huge productivity aid to have managers not interacting with the team for extended periods of time. Right. Now, do you need the manager at the beginning and the end? Absolutely, right? Okay. Those are very important interactions. But you can have a huge drop off of managerial interaction and actually have a huge gain in productivity. Agile showed that was absolutely true. So then the question is, in a multi-project, multi-manager environment where there are multiple, I'm working on multiple projects at the same time, we've got multiple clients, all that kind of thing, how do I actually put a better filter on that? And how do I actually find a way to, as a manager, say, when should I act and when should I not act? So that's to the heart of your point. Mm-hmm. The real challenge is that if I'm prone to overmanaging because I don't know better, then when should I be managing? When should I not be managing? Okay. Mm-hmm. And so the key idea in the book is around this idea of getting the team the information that they need is a absolutely important managerial function. Okay. That you are what we call the authoritative manager. In other words, here's what we need. Here's what the client is expecting. Here's where the client expects it. And we talk about it there in terms of the why and the what. Why they need it. In other words, what it relates to and all that kind of thing. And then what it is that they're looking for. The second part, which is the go, and that's the assembly line I was talking about, right? That's when people are going, right? Getting things done in the go phase, then that's where managers, like in Agile, need to be incredibly absent, right? You're available, you're there for support, but you're not intervening in the go, the productive flow of the team during that time. What happens is managers today don't do the why and the what very well. And that means they're constantly having to intervene in the go phase of things. And so the book goes into a lot of descriptions about how managers have learned to do a better job of actually explaining the why behind the work and the what behind the work. And we've proven over the last 13, 14 years here now that if you fix that why and what, then the go part goes really, really well. And you don't need to manage it heavily. So that's the shift. Literally, focus on the right things, and the other part gets pretty easy.
There's a body of literature, especially for product people, with books like "Steer the Ship" by David Markey, mm-hmm. and "Empower Teams" by Marty Kagan, and so on. What do you think you're bringing with this philosophy that hasn't been already explained in intent leadership and other philosophies like the ones that we have just gave, right? Because in Steer a Ship, David Markey, his for those people that don't know, a U.S. Navy submarine commander, right? He steers the ship by giving this intent management philosophy where sailors are expected to, in many ways, unmanage the ship, right? Which is, they become fully empowered to do what they need to do and what needs to be done to command a U.S. Navy nuclear submarine, which is something which is not really a low stakes sink if you think about it. So that's really my question. What is unmanaged trying to bring to the table with the book?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of great books out there, and the having multiple books on the same topic is not a crime or anything like that. In fact, mm-hmm. Every author brings a different perspective into these things, right? The like I would say, for example, on the Steer the Ship, it's a metaphor. Okay. It's a powerful metaphor. It's how it works on a submarine, right?
Yeah.
But the question is, a submarine is actually a bubble, if you will, mm-hmm. no pun intended, but it's a controlled microcosm in which there is only one thing going on, which is steer the ship, right?
At the time sometimes, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And most managers today live in a very different environment than that. Okay. If I was to stretch the metaphor, it would be that there are multiple submarines going on at the same time, and any given person is on multiple submarines, and those submarines are not coordinated, going in different directions with different priorities. And that multi-manager, multi-project, we call it the multi-multi environment, multi-manager, multi-project, multi-client, multi-allocated, that environment is a whole different thing than just saying, well, I'm going to give them control.
Right. So that's going from a microcosmos to a multiverse almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's the world we work in. So if if one of your lists, that's sort of it's great to get the principles. And I love the metaphor of the book. Absolutely. Very, very powerful. The question is, what's it look like in reality? Okay. It's good to be on top of the mountain, understand the theory, but how do you bring it to life in the marketplace? And that's what I think Unmanaged is about.
Is bringing this very specific context. And agencies for sure are one of the most stressful working environments out there. So let's maybe just go a little bit beyond this business. And aside from your impactful work at Agency Agile, you've ventured yourself into entrepreneurship. You've had a health solution with Snoot, nasal cleanser. Can you tell us a little bit what kind of product this is and what inspired you to develop it?
Yeah, I've always thought of myself as an inventor of sorts also, and it was a great moment. I'd been laid off, global economic downturn,
right,
and sitting at my desk every day trying to figure out what I was going to do. One of the ideas was Agency Agile, right? I'm going to figure out how to run agencies better. And I was doing a lot of writing on that. I was trying to write a book, which eventually became this book that I just published, but it's 15 years ago kind of thing. And I had chronic sinusitis my whole life, as had my mother. Horrible chronic, back then, if you're old like me, you remember people had steamers that they'd stick their face in and all kinds of things and those horrible drugs that you'd try to take and the like. And I've always done strategy and positioning work just as a side hobby. And some friends of mine were in this business around a chemical called chlorine dioxide, which is an amazing microbicide, right? They use it to clean cooling towers, clean the slime mold out of cooling towers and all kinds of strange things like that. But it's a very powerful chemical. They had an idea that you could actually do some different things with it. And I was doing basic research on the industry and the other providers and ran across this company that made, and it's amazing mouthwash called, Dioxirinse. It's a beautiful two-part mouthwash. You mix it. It does a great job of sort of sanitizing your mouth and works great. And I knew a lot about sinus colds because I'm a researcher and I've been studying what goes really wrong with your sinuses, and sinus surgeries don't generally work and all that kind of thing. And I started getting a sinus cold. And this was a thing for me that would be 4 weeks of misery. Okay. It would just be really horrible for weeks and weeks whenever I really got one. And I thought, wow, well, I knew stuff about the chemistry of the sinus lining. And I thought, what if you just sanitize this sinus lining? What if I could actually maybe put that mouthwash up my nose? Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I have nothing to lose because I'm going to be sick for 3 or 4 weeks. So how much worse am I going to be for trying this? And I actually didn't have the mouthwash. I had some other products, and there was one that's used to clean black mold out of dogs' ears. And so it's very, very strong. It's very foamy. And I went in the bathroom and sprayed it up my nose. And it felt like someone had slapped me in the face as hard as you could be slapped in the face. I was crying. I had foam coming out of my nose. And I thought, and after a few minutes of that, my nose was clear. My one side of my face was clear. I was like, well, might as well try the other side. And I did that was harder, by the way, because I knew how painful it was going to be. And after some more tears and all that, I sat down at my desk and went back to work. And then a while later, I reached for a Kleenex and I thought, oh, it's been a while, hasn't it, since I actually blew my nose. And I looked and it had been 6 hours. And I thought, wow, what happened there? I thought, well, I'll wait. And I never got the cold. And so then I called the guy who made this stuff and I told him it was a crazy idea. And he eventually relented and said, hey, I'll give you 50-50. 80-year-old inventor guy. 50-50 if you want to go run with it. And so we built the product and everything like that. But it was literally a journey of self exploration, like the old days in the farm when they'd try out drugs, two doctors looking at each other. I was standing there looking in the mirror in the bathroom with the foam coming out of my nose and tears running down my face, hoping I hadn't destroyed my sinuses.
We're eating the dog food, as they say. in this case, did you have to go through a lengthy process of approval, or is this not really medicine? So, you know.
Yeah. So the in the U.S. it's different than in other countries. I mean, sort of Europe has one set of regulations on it. The U.S. has another. The U.S. is a claims based regimen. In other words, if you make medical claims, and this is why you see that phrase, this product is not intended right. to diagnose, treat, cure, or whatever, or prevent any diseases. That you see that little sentence on things sometimes. We don't make the claim, the product doesn't make the claim that it cures chronic sinusitis, because that would make, that would say then you're a drug right. and you need FDA approval and clinical trials and all that kind of thing. Instead, you know, we claim that it helps people with sinus problems, right? And sinus problems is not a disease, okay? It's just a condition. And being helpful is not, doesn't claim that it cures anything. But, you know, and at the same time, we did go out and do, we did do what's called a double blind doctor trial. Right. It's way less expensive than doing a full pharmaceutical clinical trial, where we had, I think it was probably 25, 30 patients that under the care of five different doctors that, and, you know, some of, we sent some of them just saline water. And some of them got the product and got the product in different strengths. And everyone who used the product reported improvements, significant improvements in their condition over a four-week period. And everyone who got the placebo, in fact, reported almost no change in their condition. So beautiful data and proof of the efficacy, if you will. It helped us. We ended up getting a patent for it, right? So that was the reason we were doing it, is to show that there was some clinical evidence of it, even though you weren't approved drug.
Was the product successful?
Yeah, it's still out there. You can buy it on Amazon. It it has legions of followers who it has, I would claim, changed people's lives, and it certainly changed mine. I don't get sick like that anymore, ever. And so it's a pretty amazing little product. The it became part of a divorce battle, a little personal story. So my ex-wife runs it now. She's not a marketing person, and has not raised money to promote it or anything like that. And but it's a real gift to the world, I think. And it was kind of exciting to come up with something and do the productization and packaging and all that kind of thing. Very, very exciting.
Beautiful story. All right, so maybe going and tracing this back to your career, just circling back to your years at RAND, that's how you started, right? You started as a researcher for RAND Corporation back in...
No, I didn't actually. Yeah, sorry, but I'll just give you a real quick background. I came out as a programmer in the 1980s, came out of college as a programmer, and quickly became a manager because it paid more. And then I built a management consulting company, project management and program management consulting company. So as a program manager, I ran programs like the ones I talk about in my book, you know, where we have 120 people working on dozens of projects and all that kind of thing. And I ended up selling that company in the late 90s. I obviously did not get rich enough to retire or anything like that. But I went back and got my MBA because I thought it was really interesting. I wanted to learn how to be an entrepreneur, formally be taught how to be an entrepreneur. I loved that I did that. And it was during the summer at getting my MBA that I stumbled into an opportunity at RAND Corporation as an intern. And then I ended up being there for almost 4 years. And they invited me back a couple of years ago as a part-time researcher. And again, sort of a pinball thing, you know, just bouncing off. I'll get my MBA. All of a sudden, I'm in a think tank. Oh my gosh, now I'm in an agency. So my life sort of has a sort of interesting serendipitous. It always felt like a good step, whatever that next step was, right? How could I say no to a think tank when I'm trying to get my MBA? Because it's not really what I wanted to do, but it seems stupid to not go work at a think tank, right? So that's the origin of that.
So if people are not familiar with RAND Corporation, so RAND Corporation is one of the oldest and more established think tanks in the United States. And it was created during the Cold War specifically to fight, to help democracies win. Let's put it this way.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So offer democracies the means to, you know, to win. So what kind of work were you doing there? At least the things that you can talk about.
Well, I did do a little work on the defense side. About half the business back then was non-defense. Okay. Public policy, healthcare policy, you know, in fact, a lot of the debate around healthcare policy in the U.S. is actually a debate that was driven by Rand talking about the options and what works elsewhere in the world and that kind of thing. So about half of the business was just not strictly not defense or intelligence work. And that said, there were 1,500 researchers, and they liked me, and they asked me to stay because they only had one other MBA on the whole research staff. Everyone else, PhD, MD, PhD, all these sorts of multiple PhDs. And I ended up being this guy who, because of the very anchored, like, how do businesses work kind of training I had had and experience, I would get called in as the person to explain why the world works the way it does, right? A real simple example would be, you know, there's a military project where they wanted to understand the supplier base of people who basically small family-owned companies that do maintenance on like an Air Force base, right? These are people cleaning the floors, taking the trash out, whatever, painting the thing. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, how do we reach them? We don't even know how to survey them and find them so we can learn about them. And there's a big you know, retail industrial supplier of cleaning supplies in the U.S., if you live especially on the West Coast, called Smart and Final. And Smart and Final sells, you know, 5-gallon buckets of cleaning fluid and mops by the dozen and all that kind of thing. I said, I think you should go talk to them and ask them if you can work with their client list, because every time I go in there, it's filled with all those people who have their own small businesses and are buying, you know, 150 sponges at a time and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that was, and, you know, the researchers were like, oh, of course, mm-hmm. right? But they other, you know, they're scanning research databases trying to figure out how do I find those people. And I would, you know, I'd just drop in. It was really, really fun. So I got to work on hundreds and hundreds of different projects. And I even, for example, some of those guys were working on the climate change stuff with Al Gore back in 2001. Mm-hmm. And one of their other projects I helped them with. And then, you know, like months later, they won the Nobel Prize. So I actually got to work with some Nobel Prize winners, Nobel Prize laureates, as they're called. And one of them came to my wedding. And so it's kind of, you know, fun. You're hanging out with some really, really smart people. And it was very irresistible to just be the pet MBA monkey on the staff and the like.
Okay. So, you know, you obviously have throughout this, your career, you've garnered much experience from tech startups, major consulting gigs. What pivotal lessons have you learned that you would like to pass on to emerging product leaders and entrepreneurs?
You know, I think the biggest thing is, and it's talked about, it's called a pivot in the product space, right? Okay. The pivot is even as much as it is lauded, it's even underrated. And I think I do consider myself successful, right? In terms of I'm very happy with the path that I've followed and that kind of thing. And I think the joy I feel in that is that I trusted my gut on those pivots, because you can overanalyze the pivot. Okay. Like, for example, I literally was, when I was in grad school, I thought, I'm doing this entrepreneur program. I'm going to come out with a business plan that I will go get funding for. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm going to have mine. I'm going to be CEO of something, whatever, .com. Right. And
those were the days.
There was
those
a moment that. Yeah. Yeah.
End of
exactly,
90s.
Yeah.
We're doing an MBA. Those were the days, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And all of a sudden I was presented with this opportunity that this strange thing, well, why don't you instead come work in a think tank? And it wasn't what I'd gone to school for. Mm-hmm. Right. And in fact, there are a bunch of people that aren't like me at all. And I thought, you know, it feels right. It's not what I wanted to do, but it feels right. It feels like the right thing. And I realized several years later, essentially my dad, who is an economist, he said, you know, you're marked now. You have this mark on you, which is you were a Rand researcher and and there for many years, right? So that's the, all of a sudden that changes your, you know, both the experience changes your perspective, which I love, but also that just that credential, which I totally underestimated at the time, but the things you learn when you do a pivot that matches your heart, I think are far more powerful than the things you learn when you overanalyze it, right? Okay. And I think that's the, trust yourself. And I know that's maybe not the most clever message, but I think it's a really important one for entrepreneurs.
Absolutely. Jack, it's been incredibly insightful talking to you. Where can our listeners learn more about Agency Agile and where can they find a book?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Of course, agencyagile.com. We are going to be changing the name of the company as well. You'll be able to find us there, but also we're relaunching as Better Company because the work we do spans larger than agency agile, you know, than agile techniques. It always has for at least a decade now. But you can find it more about us there and reach out to us via contact form. I love to hear from listeners and readers. And so feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. And I have conversations all the time. I'm always publishing new work. I've got a new piece coming out right now on the Million Dollar Margin Massacre, how essentially agencies destroy their margins through bad practices and the like. So all that stuff there. You can find my book everywhere books are sold, but there's only one place where it seems books are sold these days, at least based on my data, which is Amazon, of course. And we're in the paperback and ebook are available in all the standard Amazon 19 countries and all that kind of thing. So.
Well, thank you, Jack, for sharing your journey and wisdom with us today. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Be sure to join us next time for more discussions with the leaders shaping our world in product and design. Thank you.
Thank you, Andre. Real pleasure.